Hello and welcome to the Chip War episode of Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week. I'm Felix Salmon of Axios, here with Elizabeth Spires.
Hello.
Here with Emily Peck of Axios.
Hello, hello.
And we are talking about semiconductors this week. This is a subject we haven't talked nearly enough about, given its absolutely central importance to absolutely everything on the planet. One of the reasons that we haven't talked nearly enough about it is because we haven't had the perfect person to come on and talk about it. But now we do. Chris Miller, introduce yourself.
I'm Chris Miller, associate professor at the Fletcher School and author of a new book called Chip War, The Fight for the World's Most Critical Technology.
And you just won the FT Book of the Year Award.
That's right, yes.
Which means your book is the best book that was published last year.
According to the FT, I guess.
Well, congratulations on that. We will talk a lot about your book. We're talking about war and weaponry. We're talking about globalization versus internationalization. We're talking about quantum lithography, and we're talking about Moore's Law. We have a whole bunch of really interesting stuff coming up. But basically, if you want to understand the most important factor that has driven technological advance for the past 50 years and probably will for the next 50 years, you should be listening to everything coming up on Slate Money.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So, Chris, you have written a book, it's fascinating, about basically the intersection of the evolution of semiconductors and how they've become more sophisticated over the years and national security.
That's right. I started actually trying to write a book on the arms race during the Cold War, wanting to understand how missiles developed. And I came to realize that the interesting part of that question and the driver of development in military technology was ever more advanced electronics. And if you dig into military systems, just like if you dig into cars or smartphones, what you find is a lot of semiconductors inside. And when I realized that the first semiconductors emerged out of missile guidance systems, I began to understand that my existing knowledge about how the world worked and how the global economy functioned was missing something incredibly important, which was the central role that computer chips have played.
And like, if I can oversimplify massively, the United States had better chips than everyone else from sort of the tail end of the Vietnam War onwards. That gave it a significant advantage over everyone else until now, basically. And one of the theses of your book, perhaps, correct me if I'm wrong here, is that like now that the semiconductor industry is so incredibly globalized and with important companies in every part of the world, that idea that the US could have a big semiconductor moat over every other country seems a little bit like that's not going to be able to last much longer.
Well, I think it's an open question as to whether it can last longer. The status quo right now is that advanced chip making requires inputs, materials, software, chip designs from a number of different countries, the US, Japan, Taiwan, the Netherlands, but all of them are US allies. The big shift over the past couple of years is that China has been trying to make itself a major player in semiconductors. And still today, it's fairly far behind in a number of critical spheres, but it's trying hard to catch up, having some success in doing so. And if it does succeed, then it will likely be able to apply those advances to military systems and to intelligence systems, and therefore close some of the gap with the United States.
When I read the book, which I really liked, I came away less worried as an American about losing the chip war than I did coming into the book. Because for all the worrying over chip manufacturing, which I guess is, as you write, mostly the highest end chips are manufactured in Taiwan now, and that's like a big part of concern, and we're trying to reshore that to the U.S., even though the U.S. doesn't manufacture the chips, U.S. companies play a big role in designing the chips, and the highest end tech comes from the U.S. So this idea that we're like losing this war, this chip war, seems maybe overblown.
Yeah, I think if your focus solely on the question of is the U.S. positioned well to make money in the semiconductor supply chain, the answer is clearly yes. Mm-hmm. And there's a bunch of really successful and profitable U.S. chip firms. The risks, I think, are not in that sphere, but in two different spheres. One is that the entire world is critically reliant on Taiwan to produce our most advanced chips, which is problematic if you think the risk of war is rising. And two, as we discussed at the outset, the U.S. lead over its primary geopolitical rival, China, is declining. It still exists, but it's much smaller than it was a decade ago.
Oh, when you say lead, do you mean lead in terms of like military materiel?
Well, I would say first lead in semiconductors, but then I would posit that second, whichever countries have an advantage in computing power, in other words, chips, are going to deploy those advantages to intelligence and military systems. I think there's a direct relationship between the two that history shows is pretty much ironclad. From the first computers that were deployed during World War II to crack German codes by the British, to the first computers in the U.S. that were designed to calculate artillery trajectory, to the use of supercomputers in the 1970s to track Soviet submarines, there isn't a great power in world history that has had advanced computing and not tried to apply it to intelligence and to military systems.
Right. But I mean, all you need to do is look at Afghanistan to show that doesn't get you everywhere, right?
Sure. Yeah. Computers can't solve all problems. I think for certain types of problems, computers are very, very effective at solving problems. So if you look at intelligence, if you look at weapons design, if you look at guiding autonomous systems, there's a number of spheres that are quite plausibly going to be very important, already are important, and will be increasingly important in strategic competition and military power that are incredibly computing intensive.
Yeah, in the book, you outline a lot of different scenarios that could happen with the conflict between Taiwan and China. What do you think is the most likely, and how does that affect the semiconductor industry globally, in the U.S. specifically?
So the most likely scenario, I guess the question is what time horizon we're talking about. If we take a 10-year time horizon, I think the most likely scenario is that war is avoided in the Taiwan Straits, that China fails to catch up in terms of reaching the cutting edge in chip making, and the U.S., Taiwan, Japan, and others retain both their technological lead and, as a result, also their collective military lead over China. But my confidence in that prediction is a lot lower than it would have been 5 years ago. In other words, the likelihood of war, I think, by any estimate, is higher than it was 5 years ago. And China's advances over the last 10 years have been quite impressive. Not complete, but they've made real progress.
So what happens, like, if China successfully invades Taiwan somehow, like, what changes? Presumably, no one in China particularly wants TSMC, the big semiconductor fabricator in Taiwan, to go out of business.
It would go out of business on day one of the war. The moment fighting starts, TSMC's facilities would stop producing and would never be reopened. We're talking about the most complex, the most expensive factory in human history, with the most expensive and precise machine tools in human history. There is no way a semiconductor facility is going to survive a war. And even if it did, TSMC's facilities in Taiwan only function because they're able to import tools and materials from Japan, the US, the Netherlands, and other countries. So there's a 0% chance that China can, in a war, acquire TSMC's capabilities. The risk is not that they acquire them, but that they knock them out. And the world, which today relies on Taiwan for the production of over one third of the new computing power we add each year, if that disappears, the entire world economy heads into a deep manufacturing depression, because it's not only smartphones or PCs that we couldn't produce, it's autos and dishwashers and microwaves.
But that's a big reason for China not to start a war, right? Because China would be hurt just as much as anyone else, where those Taiwanese chips are a key input into what most of China's exports.
That's right. Yeah. So mutually assured economic destruction, if you will, is a force that mitigates against conflict. But I think our confidence in that has got to be lower than it was several years ago. I mean, it was a bad predictor, for example, of global politics in 2022. It was a horrible predictor because Angela Merkel's energy strategy was predicated on the thesis that energy interdependence with Russia would make Russia more amenable to cooperation with Germany. The result was the opposite. It went so far that Russia, it appears, blew up the pipelines that connected Germany with gas. So I don't think complete faith in mutually assured economic interdependence is a very wise position to take. I think we can say it's plausible that will work. It might work. But anyone who says they're highly confident it will work, I think is vastly overstating the evidence. And I think if you look historically, it's not just 2022. You can go back to Britain and Germany right before World War I. Large trading partners, huge foreign investment links, portfolio capital flows, they all went to zero very, very quickly right after August 1914. So it's hard to find good historical evidence for the extreme confidence that most Americans, for example, have in trade and investment flows guaranteeing peace.
And you are, as they say in Britain, an old China hand. So like when you talk to people on the mainland, when you talk to Chinese folks, what do they think of this mutually assured economic destruction argument? Do they buy it, or are they completely unconvinced by it?
I think it depends on who you speak to. I think business elites in every country certainly hope that it's true. The question, though, is probably not what business elites think, because they're usually not making security policy. The question is more, what do the security services think, and what do the political elites think? And I think we've got to acknowledge that there's a fair amount of uncertainty, to be honest, over what drives Chinese elite political thinking and what drives Xi Jinping's thinking personally. There are very few people that have correctly predicted all the twists and turns, for example, of China's zero COVID policy this year.
including
Xi Jinping. And so I think we've got to kind of put uncertainty at the center of our analysis. But if there's uncertainty over whether or not we're going to have access to semiconductors next year, that makes me pretty nervous. And so even if your estimate of the risk of war over the next decade is 20%, let's say, well, 20% times a estimated cost of many trillions of dollars ought to make you pretty interested in this question.
So the U.S. in the fall passed the CHIPS Act. I think it's like $284 billion or something. And part of that's going to spur manufacturing in the U.S. How does that at all change the equation long term for if the scenario you're talking about happens? Can the U.S. then pick up the slack?
On the one hand, the around $40 billion of manufacturing incentives that the CHIPS Act is going to spend is small relative to the capital expenditure in a single year that the global industry spends. On the other hand, I think if you look at the CHIPS Act, not on its own, but next to what the EU is about to spend on its own CHIPS initiative, what Japan is already spending, what India, what Korea, what a number of other countries are spending, what you find is that there's a big increase in capital expenditure outside of Taiwan and China. There's a big increase inside of China too, which we can discuss. But the result of that is that there will be meaningfully more capacity outside the Taiwan Straits in 5 years' time than there would have been in the absence of the CHIPS Act plus the other countries' policies that I discussed. Now, is that enough to eliminate the impact of a crisis in Taiwan? Absolutely not. But is it an insurance policy that I'd like to have given the risk that I assess and the relative cost of the CHIPS Act? I think so. And when you buy an insurance policy, you don't expect it to be perfect. You don't expect it to pay all your costs, but you look at it as an expected value equation. And that's exactly the right way to look at the CHIPS Act, I think.
You do have a fascinating bit in your book, a lovely little anecdote about, I think it was Morris Chang, saying like, if I have a machine that breaks at 1 o'clock in the morning, then, you know, in America, they'll fix it first thing in the morning. And in Taiwan, they'll fix it by 2 o'clock in the morning. And that kind of like huge focus on efficiency. One of the phrases that comes up over and over again in your book is cutthroat competition, that there's just like everyone is seeking any tiny edge they can get over anyone else. It does seem that small gains here and there, what seem like they might be small gains here and there, do wind up having existential consequences for chip manufacturers.
Well, they're certainly important. I mean, existential, I'm not sure, because every chip maker is going to be facing the same pressure over the next 5 or 10 years to rejig the geography of their production. There's just going to be more chips made in more expensive locations. And so in some ways that levels the playing field between chip makers. Will it feed into higher prices for your iPhone? On the margin, it will. But we're talking about, I think, on the margin. If you ask what's the share of your iPhone that is due to chip manufacturing, it's a relatively small number. And so if prices for that specific segment go up by a couple percentage points, that's not going to be a decisive factor in whether or not you upgrade your iPhone.
So how would you describe China's strategic response to these export controls? What are they doing primarily? I mean, you mentioned in the book that they're moving toward open source architecture, so they're not relying on Western designs. What else is happening?
Well, China's in a really tough position right now. And part of the problem, I think, is that the government hasn't listened enough to its tech sector. There are steps that China can take to try to find ways around these controls. But the key thing that China lacks today is the precise machine tools needed to manufacture chips. And today, the most advanced machine tools are produced by just a handful of companies in the US, Japan, and one firm in the Netherlands. And domestic Chinese competitors are just miles behind in terms of the precision at which they're able to manufacture. And so there's no sort of open source way around that challenge. You either have the tools or you don't. And right now, China doesn't. And it's going to be a very long time, I think, measured in years, before China's able to make much progress at all in acquiring these tools. And if you've spoken with someone in the Chinese chip industry off the record, you know, in the last couple of years, they would have admitted that. And they would have said, we're making progress, but we're making progress thanks to the fact that we're able to access the best tools and components from the international semiconductor ecosystem. The problem was that China's government wasn't, I don't think, listening enough to their tech sector. And they thought self-sufficiency was going to be viable far sooner than it actually was, which is why China's government has been pushing in a direction that is, I think, not all that practical. And that's why there's, I think, a wave of pessimism right now crashing over China's tech industry and certainly the semiconductor segment of the tech industry about what prospects actually are for catching up.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Your pet is one of a kind, and so is their journey. While every playful moment is a memory in the making, sometimes cats and dogs are a little too good at getting into trouble. That's why you should check out ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need.
The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
Can you talk a little bit about the wave of sort of dragon slaying that seems to have overtaken the American government over the past 5 years or so? There was a really quite startling move from the sort of Davos consensus of globalization is good to the situation we're in now, where, you know, a dumb app like TikTok is considered to be a national security concern and is likely to get banned. And we've, you know, shut down Chinese manufacturers, as you recount in your book. Xinhua was shut down by America just because it was Chinese, basically. Huawei is a shadow of its former self because the Americans considered it to be a strategic threat. Like, when and why did that shift happen?
So I think underlying a lot of the excitement about globalization from the 1990s up to the last couple of years was an assumption that wasn't really recognized, but was widely present in the US and Europe, Japan and elsewhere, that globalization wouldn't create shifts in the geopolitical balance. And in the 1990s and 2000s, that was an easy assumption to make because the US was the world's unrivaled military power. China was far behind, and anyway, most Western leaders and most Western elites sort of assumed that China was going to move closer to Western political thinking anyway, and so wouldn't really challenge the U.S. or the West in their position at the top. And I think around 2015 or so, that those assumptions began to be called into question for the first time. Both because China's military power grew and grew and America's didn't, especially after the embarrassments in the Middle East. And second, because Xi Jinping took Chinese politics in a much more openly authoritarian direction. And it was no longer really viable to tell a story of China evolving in a positive way as it had been under Hu Jintao. And so those factors combined, I think, to create this rethinking of globalization. Whereas today, I don't think that Western leaders are really questioning globalization. They're just questioning China. You still see lots of globalization in terms of Japanese investment in the US and Taiwanese investment in Europe, et cetera. It's just China's role in it because there's concern that the existing trade framework, the existing investment framework and technology transfer framework was allowing China to grow in power in ways that made Western elites uncomfortable.
Would you agree that TikTok is a national security concern, or is that like a little bit weird?
I mean, I think we should assume that every government is going to use whatever data it has and whatever computing power it has to spy on its adversaries. And that's just the history of governments and technology.
Or in the case of China, its own population.
Well, that's true. But even if you step out of the unique aspects of Chinese governance, it's just a fact that every government, you know, since the days of telegraph cables, have tried to tap into telegraph cables, tapping into undersea cables, tapping into phone networks. That's just what governments do. And like it or dislike it, that's the reality. It seems like everything we've learned from the Snowden revelations of a decade ago confirms that the U.S. government is undertaking similar espionage operations. And so the assumption that China wouldn't do the same seems to me a really hard to justify assumption, especially when you consider, Felix, what you mentioned about what we know about China.
So like, assume they are getting all manner of information about what kind of videos I'm watching on TikTok, or even about, like, you know, the information that my phone is capturing about me. They know what I look like, my facial features, whatever. Like, have we reached the point, and I guess this is actually a semiconductor question, ultimately, have we reached the point in terms of computing power that we've reached the level of computational sophistication that the Chinese government could take that insane quantity of data and extract meaningful signals out of it that would give it some kind of a geopolitical advantage?
Yeah, it seems like intelligence agencies around the world are investing more and more in trying to acquire data and understand it. And so it seems like most of the world's intelligence agencies believe that there's a lot of value in getting access to data, consumer data, civilian data, as well as more kind of unique or niche intelligence data.
I was really struck in your book when you talked about computing power and weapons, and how in the first Gulf War, kind of the whole world was kind of dumbstruck by the power of the United States' weaponry at that point, and that was all powered by chips. Is there a potential for that moment to happen again with that kind of weaponry, or is now the real advantage is moving to what you and Felix were just talking about, you know, the capacity to spy or process data?
Well, I feel it's happening right now in Ukraine, right? Like the Ukraine fighters are using weapons, you know, Javelin missiles with chips that the Russians don't have, and they're destroying Russian targets much more efficiently than vice versa.
So I think it's a little bit more complex than that, because if you take a Javelin missile, you know, there's no chip in that is more sophisticated than what's in your iPhone, and quite the opposite, actually. And today, just like your iPhone knows where you are within a couple of feet, so too, it's easy to guide a missile from a chip perspective within a couple of feet of its target. Now, it gets a bit more complex if you've got a drone, you want to fly it within a couple of feet of its target, it needs to know how to fly, you've got to train it to fly that way. And then when you start layering on GPS jamming, which is widespread in the battlefields in Ukraine and other types of electronic warfare to blind it so it doesn't know where it is or who it's communicating with, having access to more computational capacity and also some of the unique types of semiconductors that are used in communications and sensors becomes quite useful. And so there's a lot that differentiates, you know, a drone you can buy on Amazon to a drone the U.S. military would deploy. And the ability to get to their location is not as simple as it might sound. But I think actually the next generation we should be thinking about is, well, what happens as we apply more impressive artificial intelligence to military systems? Because it's going to happen. And the question is, what does that look like? And the honest answer is, in some ways, we're not yet even really sure. But I think, you know, anyone who's played around with ChatGPT realizes, you know, there's some really interesting capabilities here, which could be used for good or for otherwise. And I think you probably want to be confident that your government has access to more advanced technologies than rivals, or at least the ability to try to plug them into military systems before adversaries do.
Would I be wrong then in my assumption? Because I've had this assumption for like a few months now that one of the main reasons why the Russians have been struggling more or less from day one in Ukraine is because their technology just isn't that good. Is that not right?
I think that's right. But I think it's a complex story. You know, why is their technology not that good? Is a mix of the hardware is not that good, the software is not that good. When they operate together, it's not that good. It's not as though the Russians are missing one specific component and then it would become better. It's a complex system. And so there's lots of different components that the Russians are missing or have bad versions of, which leads to a system that doesn't work very well.
Does China have all of that already?
Well, we don't know. I think it's a hard question to ask in the abstract. I think you know, anyone on the street would hypothesize that China's got better tech and computing hardware than Russia, and that China's got better software design capabilities than Russia. Now, does that feed over directly into military spheres? Well, it's probably more complicated because there are some unique military spheres like undersea warfare that don't really have civilian analogs and so might operate differently. Jet engines, another kind of unique sphere. But it certainly seems like China's got a better starting point than Russia to harness some of these technologies for military purposes. What we do know is that when it comes to making the most advanced chips, China is still meaningfully behind what the U.S. plus Taiwan can produce. And that's
but meaningfully ahead of Russia.
Correct. Correct. Far ahead of Russia.
Which I wanted to ask you about this. Earlier this month, there was a summit meeting between Xi and Putin. Can you tell us a little bit about that relationship and what that means, for Russia at least to maybe potentially get up to the level of China, if not the level of the United States when it comes to technology?
Well, the Russians are ever more reliant on the Chinese in macroeconomic terms, in civilian technology terms. But to talk about military technology requires zooming in on what exactly we're talking about. Because there are certain spheres in terms of defense technology where the Russians are still ahead of the Chinese. So aircraft engines. Chinese can't make good jet engines. The Russians still can. Submarines. Seems like the Russians are probably still ahead. So it's not a simple thing, technology that can be transferred. There's lots of different types of technology and they all get transferred in different ways and plug into systems in different ways. And so it's a complex and nuanced picture. But certainly the Chinese can provide some components that the West used to provide and is now trying to cut the Russians off from. And so a big challenge, I think, for Western export control enforcement now vis-a-vis Russia, now that we're trying to prevent Russia from accessing all sorts of high-tech equipment, is can we also stop China from selling Russia that equipment? In a lot of cases, it's illegal under U.S. law for Chinese firms to sell Russia certain things because Chinese firms are producing them using U.S.-produced tools. But our ability to actually stop those transactions, if they're happening directly between Russia and China, is much more complex.
So, and can you just like zoom back a bit and explain, like, is being nice to the Russians something that China wants, and why would they want it? Explain the relationship between those two countries a bit.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't really say that the Chinese are being nice to the Russians. I'd say that they're taking advantage of the fact that Russia is in a pretty weak negotiating position right now. And China's buying discounted oil from the Russians. It's buying all sorts of discounted raw materials from the Russians. And if you didn't have any sort of moral or political views on the Russia-Ukraine war, you'd be doing the same thing. And I think that's exactly where Chinese leaders are today.
So the sort of the hype about China and Russia banding together and forging a new world order is overblown?
I think it is. I think there's no new world order that's emerged. There's
had to ask.
There's cooperation. I mean, I think the interesting thing is there's more direct military cooperation between Russia and Iran mm-hmm. that we're aware of than between Russia and China.
Is it just leftover paranoia from the Cold War, do you think?
Well, I think it's reasonable to be, just given the size of Russia and China, it's reasonable to be focused on the issue of their relationship. So I don't know if paranoia is the right word. But yes, I think China's been less helpful to Russia than Russia might like.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
I want to get a little bit nerdy when it comes to chip manufacture, because you devote a large, pretty large chunk of your book to this technology called EUV, which is extreme ultraviolet, and which was developed at astonishing expense and which underlies the most advanced chip manufacturing that we're doing today, mostly in Taiwan, but with machines made by a Dutch company with components made in San Diego. It gets very complicated very quickly. But the question I have is, like, you talk a bunch about how TSMC has been really good at using these machines to make fantastic chips, and also about how, like, Intel hasn't, and how there was another American company, Global Foundries, that kind of tried and failed. That just having the machines doesn't seem to be enough. There's something else. And a lot of your book seems to be, at some level, you kind of say, well, there was something cultural or structural, like, or a little bit vague or hand-wavy, and it just didn't work very well. And can you talk a little bit about those? There's a lot of just, like, almost managerial inputs into making chips.
Yeah, I think that's crucial to understanding what we mean when we talk about technology, because we're talking not just about devices, but also the management of different tools to make those devices. And it often is the management, or what people in the industry often call the secret sauce of TSMC, that explains why they're ahead of their rivals. I think part of the challenge of chip making is that you've got not only one ultra precise machine tool, but you've got a whole suite of them that you need to make chips. Some of them shine extreme ultraviolet light at chips. Others lay down thin films of material, just a couple of atoms thick. Others etch canyons into the silicon, just a couple of atoms wide. And so all of this is happening thousands of times on any given piece of silicon to make the chips that eventually emerge. And so you need to use all these tools precisely together. And there's no pre-existing recipe to do so. You can't just sort of download the recipe from the manufacturer, because the manufacturers don't know how to use the machines to their optimal capability. And so it's sort of like a constant science experiment at TSMC, is that how do you use all these tools most effectively?
Wow. So ASML is, right, is the Dutch company that makes the lithography machines. You're saying that TSMC is actually better at using ASML's machines than ASML is.
That's right, because ASML knows how to make the machines, but TSMC knows how to use them. And when you talk about their relationship, or the relationship of many of the tool makers to the chip makers, it's really a surprisingly deep partnership. So, for example, in TSMC's facilities in Taiwan, they'll have ASML staff permanently on site, tweaking the machines, fixing problems that arise. And ASML is not the only company that makes these types of tools that has staff permanently on site. And when ASML or the other tool makers are designing their next generation of tools, they're designing them hand in hand with companies like TSMC or Intel, because those will be the biggest customers, and because they need to make the tools work in a way that will fit in this much broader production process that these companies are envisioning for the next generation.
It's really wonderfully global. Like, the idea that the chip industry can be reshored is just it seems absurd. This is an industry that, yeah, it's so global. It's so interconnected, international, and not in any of the ways that you typically think are, quote unquote, or bad or anything, like you were saying before. The workers aren't underpaid. This isn't what it's about.
Yeah, I would caveat that with one distinction, which is that it's not so much global as it is international.
Mm.
Because there are lots of big countries that play basically no role in the process of making advanced chips. And, you know, you think of major economies like India or Brazil, totally irrelevant when it comes to chip making. And even France, Italy, they have some medium-sized chip makers. But when it comes to the most advanced chips, you can go a long way without touching major European economies too. And so that's what makes the industry interesting to political leaders, is that if you're one of the countries that has a unique position in the chip industry, you can use it because many of your trading partners don't have those capabilities.
There is a bit of your book where you actually break out the numbers. So the total supply chain market share, which I wrote down because I had no idea. There are basically three countries with significant market share in the semiconductor supply chain. US is number one at 39%. Korea is number two at 16%, and Taiwan is number three at 12%, which, like, all of this talk about Taiwan has a monopoly on advanced semiconductor manufacturers, it does, that's true, but it's still only 12% of the total supply chain. And that's it, basically. China's like a distant fourth on 6%.
Yep, that's right. And I think, you know, again, the sort of differentiation is that refers to dollar value, but that doesn't reflect the fact that you can't produce an advanced chip in Taiwan or anywhere else without machines from the Netherlands or machines and materials from Japan. And so you know, Europe plays a small role in dollar terms, but it plays a absolutely critical role in terms of the production process, because it would be impossible to make advanced chips without ASML's tools.
Yeah, there's a thing you talk about in the book a lot, where you really illustrate where these choke points are and how easy it is to, you know, cripple the entire supply chain, particularly the company in the Netherlands that makes photolithography tools. It's striking that there's one company that does that, and it's completely irreplaceable. Do you think that this is what the industry looks like indefinitely, or is this just what it looks like now?
Well, I think there's some pretty deep set structural factors that lead to this this position of a small number of firms having really strong market positions. You know, first off, the level of technical expertise that's built up in these firms is just really, really high. And you can't download a book on learning about EUV and make any progress in a short period of time. You kind of need to work at these companies to know how the stuff works. And so it's hard to develop expertise outside of these firms. Second, the capital investment is just enormous. A new chip making facility costs $20 billion. You know, your startup is not going to raise $20 billion. And that's why in key parts of the chip industry, companies have been in their position for decades in many cases, because they've got unique expertise and they've got very, very expensive business models that really disincentivize any startup competitors.
One of the things that's fascinating about the book is the way in which the senior executives that you write about invariably have advanced degrees in engineering or like particle physics or something from like top universities. This isn't like the managerial class. It wasn't until, I guess, the 1990s or maybe even the 2000s. There's this wonderful bit where Morris Chang, who's like basically, like, what is he at that point? The COO of Texas Instruments or something like that. He basically invents this important new thing called step photolithography by like hanging out at an industry conference and like talking to a vendor and saying, well, why don't you just do it like this? And they're like, oh, that's a good idea. And the idea that like that the C-suite is getting its hands dirty in technological advances, is that still the case?
Well, it's an interesting question. It's certainly the case if you look at a TSMC where the leadership is still all has backgrounds in electrical engineering or material science. For the chip design firms that that are the big players in U.S. industry, chip design is essentially a type of programming today. And so it's not the case that at most of the big chip designers, you see people rolling up their sleeves because there's nothing to roll up your sleeves into. There's no chemicals you're grabbing or tools you're using beyond your computer. And so that is a big change from the way it used to be. And as the industry has gotten more complex, it's had to have this differentiation between the designers and the manufacturers. But it does mean that the U.S. industry is much less physical than it used to be, because the U.S. focus has been on the chip design process.
Can I also ask, I think there are like two women in the book total, I think. Is that just reflective of this industry, or is it just completely male-dominated industry? Should I be worried about this industry?
Certainly. Well, it's interesting. So historically, the chip design process, the manufacturing process was male dominated. The assembly process was almost all women in the early stages.
Right.
First woman in California, and then when they got too expensive, women in Southeast Asia. So in some ways, it's not accurate to say that the industry was male dominated. Mm. The leadership of the industry was male dominated.
I mean,
but
literally
the workers
dominated by men.
Dominated,
running
the
industry.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. Has it changed? You know, it's changed somewhat. I think, you know, it's certainly far from parity in terms of genders. There's a number of influential CEOs today who are women. AMD's Lisa Su, for example, is one of the most successful chip CEOs of her generation. But yeah, certainly it's an industry that is, I think, far more so even than computer science, which has gotten its fair share of criticism.
Mm-hmm.
Hello, I'm Imi Harper. On the Slow Newscast from Tortoise, I tell the story of how a Hong Kong billionaire was silenced.
I got bombs thrown into my house. I got people came here, ransacked my computer. And I got people fracturing me. I got this and that, but I'm safe.
And what it reveals about the freedoms Hong Kong no longer enjoys. Listen to Hong Kong's Rebel Billionaire on the Slow Newscast, wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, let's do a quick numbers round. Emily,
yeah.
You have an awesome number. What's your number?
I'm really happy about my number. It's $6.25.
Okay.
Oh, that is the average cost in November of 16 ounces of potato chips. <laughs> the only chip I have expertise in. And that's pretty high, 6.25. It's up almost 20% from last year. And that's from the BLS, from the CPI.
And potato chips have a curiously starring role in your book, Chris, because they were like the genesis of Micron.
That's right.
Yeah, that's right. Oh my gosh.
The guy who funded Micron made his fortune selling potatoes, actually mostly French fries, to McDonald's.
What we English people call chips.
That's right.
Elizabeth, do you have a number?
Yeah, my number is 90, and that's a percentage, and that's the percentage amount that eBay searches for Nikon Coolpix cameras have gone up, because apparently Gen Zers now, in their quest to adopt all the things that Gen Xers liked in the 90s, have decided that point-and-shoot cameras are cooler than using your iPhone to document parties and things, and so now they're buying them off the secondary market. They like that the photos look crappier. That's part of the art.
Yeah, well, it's because they're all going to the Wolfgang Tillmann's show at MoMA, and they're like, yeah, early digital photography. It had that vibe, man, which was amazing. My number is 179, which is the number of expletives that were recorded on earnings calls in 2022. Which apparently is an all-time high. The CEOs are swearing more. In 2012, it was just 48.
Oh, shit.
This is a fucking big deal, I'm telling you.
What's going on?
The fucking CEOs are fucking fed up. Chris, we're going to let you come up with the final number here.
All right, well, I've got a number for you. It's 457,329, which is the number of component parts in just the laser segment of an EUV lithography tool, which are used to make the most advanced chips.
The laser stuff was crazy. They're creating these like vacuums and firing lasers at microscopic tin balls and like focusing. I mean, it's like science fiction stuff.
The explosion that happens inside these tools is around 50 times hotter than the surface of the sun.
And then we're like on our phones and we're like, this isn't working right. It's so unbelievable.
How big are these machines?
They're huge. They take a couple of 747s to move.
I have this vision now in my head of like two 747s like going up next to each other and dangling a machine between them. This has been fantastic. I want to do a Slate Plus segment on Moore's Law. But for those of us who aren't Slate Plus subscribers, Chris Miller, thank you so much for coming on this show. This has been incredibly enlightening. We've all learned so much. And I think, honestly, like, relatively optimistic.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm glad you took away an optimistic conclusion.
With that, I think we'll wrap up the main part of Slate Money here. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks so much for sending in emails. SlateMoney@Slate.com. And many thanks to Anna Phillips for producing, who's the best. And we'll be back next week with more Slate Money.